This is the fifth day of this January 2012 Rohatsu session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of Japanese Zen master Bankei, who lived in the 17th century mainly. And this is from a book called Bankei Zen by Peter Haskell, translated by Peter Haskell. Before I begin, I'd like to read a poem, kind of a prose poem, called Ballad of the Paths in Vestmanland by Lars Gustafsson, Swedish, originally Swedish, in Swedish. Let me just first say it's in this session, in honor of the Buddha's great enlightenment, it may be worth remembering that the Buddha really had no path. He certainly didn't have Buddhism, any kind of Buddhist path to follow. He was a desperate man. He had tried for 6 years. He had tried all the many forms of asceticism, subjecting himself to all kinds of privations and pain in an effort to somehow find liberation from the dictates of the body, the body-mind. And just because there was nothing that had satisfied him, nothing that had worked for him to the degree that he longed for, he just found himself sitting with abandon, this complete questioning. And after that great enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he had opened this path for us, a path we call the Dharma, in particular the Mahayana, the great vehicle. We are the beneficiaries of this absolutely marvelous and faultless Dharma. And we need only stay on this path. Here's the poem. Under the visible script of small tracks, gravel tracks, forest tracks, often with a grass ridge in the middle, between deep ruts hidden beneath twigs heaped in clearings, still distinct in crumbling moss, another script runs, the old paths. They lead from lake to lake, from valley to valley. Sometimes deeper furrows, more distinct, and sturdy bridges of medieval stone carry them over black streams. Sometimes they evaporate on bare, rocky ground. You lose them easily in swamps, so imperceptibly that one moment they are there and the next not. They do go on. Always there's a going on. You only have to seek. The paths are obstinate. They know what they want. And with that knowledge, they combine considerable cunning. You walk east, the compass points insistently east. Faithfully, the path follows the compass like a streak. All is well. Then the path veers north. And north, there's nothing. What does the path want? Soon comes an enormous moor, and the path knew it. It leads us around with the certainty of someone who knows what's what. It knows where the moor is. It knows where the hill is too steep. It knows what happens to someone who circles the lake to the north instead of south. It has done it all so many times before. That's the whole point of being a path. It came to be made long ago. Who made it? Charcoal burners, fisher folk, women with skinny arms gathering firewood, the outlaws, shysters, gray as the moss, still in their dreams, the blood of fratricide reddens their hands, autumn hunters on the tracks of pointer dogs with barks clear as frost, all of them, none of them. We make the path together, you, too, on a stormy day, on earth, be the hours late or early. We write the paths, and they stick, and the paths are more clever than us, and they know all the things we wanted to know. Now, back to our text. This is in the section of the book called, it's called Sermons, but let's call them Dharma Talks. And the master says, the master said, or a monk asked the master, what is enlightenment? The master replied, there's no such thing as enlightenment. It's a completely extraneous pursuit. To realize conclusively that the Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is unborn and marvelously illuminating, that's enlightenment. Not realizing this makes you deluded. Since the original Buddha mind is unborn, it functions without thoughts of delusion or thoughts of wanting to be enlightened. As soon as you think of wanting to be enlightened, you leave the place of the unborn and go counter to it. Because the Buddha mind is unborn, it has no thoughts at all. Thoughts are the source of delusion. When thoughts are gone, delusion vanishes too. And once you've stopped being deluded, talking about wanting to attain enlightenment certainly is useless, don't you agree? Now, of course, Bankei is not saying there's no enlightenment experience that one can have. We've read enough in this book. What we didn't read, just to review this, was his autobiographical account. We mentioned it in the biographical account, but in his own words, so only at Doshas, that was his second teacher, did I finally receive some small confirmation of my enlightenment. At that time, it was hard to find anyone who could testify with certainty to my experience, and I had quite a lot of trouble. That's why, thinking back now over what it was like for me, I come out like this every day to meet with all of you, ailing though I am. If there's anyone here now who's experienced enlightenment, whoever he is, the only reason I've come out like this is so that I can be your witness. You people certainly are lucky. Since you have someone who can testify to your experience through and through, if there's anyone here who's been enlightened or who thinks he's understood this matter, step forward and let's hear from you. I'm ready to be your witness. However, If there's no one who's understood yet, listen to what I have to say and realize conclusively. So this was introducing his talk for that day. So when he says there's no such thing as enlightenment, of course he means there's no such thing as enlightenment apart from our own mind. It's not out there. It's not in the future. It's this. There's nowhere we have to go to realize our innate enlightenment. In another talk, Bankei addressed the assembly. For one who at all times conclusively realizes the Buddha mind, when he goes to bed with the Buddha mind. When he gets up with the Buddha mind. When he stays with the Buddha mind. When he goes with the Buddha mind. When she sits with the Buddha mind. When she stands with the Buddha mind. When she sleeps with the Buddha mind. When she wakes up with the Buddha mind. When he speaks with the Buddha mind. When he's silent with the Buddha mind. When he eats rice, he eats with the Buddha mind. When he drinks tea, he drinks with the Buddha mind. When she puts on her clothes, she puts them on with the Buddha mind. At all times, she abides continually in the Buddha mind. And there's not a single moment when she isn't in the Buddha mind. She functions with perfect freedom in accordance with circumstances, letting things take their way. Just do good things and don't do bad ones. If you pride yourself on your good deeds, however, becoming attached to them and abominating the bad, that's going against the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind is neither good nor bad, but operates beyond them both. Isn't that the living Buddha mind? When you've conclusively realized this and haven't any doubts, then and there you'll open the eye that penetrates people's minds. That's why my school is called the Clear-Eyed School. A layman asked, I don't doubt that originally deluded thoughts don't exist, but since the flow of my thoughts never stops for even a moment, it's impossible for me to realize the unborn. Bankei said, when you came into this world, there was only the unborn Buddha mind. As you grew, however, you picked up the ignorant attitudes you saw around you, so that as time passed, you got used to being deluded, and the deluded mind gained a free hand. Originally, in your innate self, thoughts don't exist, so in the mind that affirms and has faith in its own unborn Buddhahood, thoughts simply vanish. It's like a man who's fond of wine, but gets sick from it and has to stop drinking. If he finds himself in a situation where wine is served, thoughts of wanting to drink may arise, but since he doesn't drink, he neither gets sick nor drunk. He's a teetotaler even while thoughts of drinking arise and ends up a healthy man. Delusory thoughts are like this too. When you simply let them arise or cease without either taking them up or rejecting them, then before you know it, they'll vanish in the mind of the unborn. Again, he's distinguishing here between the notion we have of ourself based on past behavior, conditioning, that notion rather than versus what we are doing, the way we are living at this very moment. there's a verse in the Mumonkan that says, when an ordinary man realizes, he becomes a sage. When a sage understands, he becomes an ordinary man. It's all a matter of our functioning at this moment, which determines who we are, if we can even accept those terms of who we are. We are the way we're using our mind in any given time. In another talk, a monk asked, I find it impossible to suppress all my defilements and delusions. What can I do to suppress them? I hope there is not a person here who doesn't understand that he's wrong. This questioner is wrong right from the outset. I find it impossible to suppress all my defilements and delusions. What can I do to suppress them? The master replied, trying to suppress delusion is delusion too. Delusions have no original existence. They're only things you create yourself by indulging in discrimination. A visiting monk asked, in your talk the other evening, you said that everyone innately possesses the Buddha mind. While I'm grateful for your instruction, it seems to me that if everyone were endowed with the Buddha mind, deluded thoughts couldn't arise. The master replied, right now, as you're saying this, what delusions are there? The monk prostrated himself 3 times and withdrew. We have this ingrained habit of seeing ourselves as continuing, as seeing ourselves as having this self that continues from moment to moment, from hour to hour, from year to year. But Bhanke, in his skillful way here, is keeps trying to puncture that notion, which is all it is. It's a notion. We label ourselves as this or that. We identify with ourselves as this or that, when there's no need to. At every moment, we have the freedom to choose how we use the mind or how we misuse the mind. Every moment, we get another shot at it. That's what determines who we are, is our that choice we make moment by moment. A layman asked, I admit that we see and hear with the unborn, but when we fall asleep, we're unaware even of another person right beside us. So at that time, we seem to lose the vital function of the unborn. The master said, what kind of loss is there? There's no loss at all. You've simply fallen asleep. Another time, a visiting monk asked, if one truly realizes the unborn, after the 4 elements of the physical body have dispersed, will he be born again or not? The master replied, in the place of the unborn, the whole question of being born or not being born is irrelevant. This is one of the distinctions between Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, as far as I can have observed, is that in Tibetan Buddhism, they make a lot more of rebirth and talk a lot more about past lives and future lives. And in Zen, it's all comes down to how we're using the mind right now. And that too comes from the Buddha, who was asked once, what will I be in my next life? And the Buddha said, if you want to know what you were, I guess he asked, what was I in my last life? The Buddha said, if you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now. It's all now. Really, this is all there is. Where is this thing called the past? Where is it? I don't see it anywhere. I don't hear it. Where is it other than right here? Where is this thing we call the future? I don't see a trace of it. Thoughts. Memories and thoughts. A visiting monk asked, is there any merit in practicing Zazen? This is not as silly as a question as it may strike us. Remember, he had at this big convocation the talks from which formed this book. There were Buddhists of all different kinds, not just Zen practitioners. And there are other schools of Buddhism where meditation isn't done. So this monk asks, is there any merit in practicing Zazen? The master said, Zazen isn't to be despised, nor are reciting sutras, performing prostrations, and so on. Toksan used the stick, Rinzai uttered the kots, Gute raised his finger, and Bodhidharma faced the wall. But while different, all these were just the master's expedients, methods to confront particular situations and deal with the individual needs of the students involved. Right from the start, there have never been fixed rules. If you take these temporary expedients as invariable teachings, you'll be blinding your own eyes. Simply have firm faith in what I say, remaining as you innately are without making idle distinctions, just like when things are reflected in a mirror, and then there's nothing in the world you won't penetrate through and through. Do not doubt. He's making a very important point, which is it's not in the doing of the Zazen, it's not in the sitting that is this mind, this enlightened nature of ours. The method of Zazen is a way to enable us to realize that even before we ever started doing Zazen, this luminous Buddha mind of ours has been complete, shining. But without some practice or training, it's next to impossible to realize this. Yet there are cases, rare cases of people who have realized this mind, who never did Zazen. They may well have done lifetimes of zazen in previous times. A layman asked, if you become a Buddha, which always means, remember, it always means when you become enlightened, if you become a Buddha, where do you go? The master replied, if you become a Buddha, there's no place at all to go. You fill the vast universe to its very limits. It's when you become any other sort of being that there are different places to go. So again, what we were just saying, Buddhahood, enlightenment, is beyond coming and going. Again, just like the sky. Does the sky come and go? No, it's just the sky. It's always been there. It's the clouds that come and go. Here we're now we're going back to mind reading. A layman asked, I've heard that your reverence is able to see into people's minds. Right at this moment, what am I thinking? The master said, you're thinking precisely that. A layman said, I sometimes feel startled when I'm surprised by some sound, such as a clap of thunder. Is this because I'm not in control all the time? How can I guard against this so that no matter what happens, I won't feel startled? The master said, if you feel startled, it's fine just to feel that way. When you try to guard against it, you're creating duality. This actually is advice we can use for any kind of feeling. We're not trying to guard against feelings or natural autonomic responses, body-mind responses. What we're trying to do is to get beyond thoughts about our reactions, thinking in terms of right or wrong, or good or bad. I can't imagine that anyone could transcend the startle response that's just wired in us. Think if a gunshot went out from the Zendo right now, there'd be no one startled, or anyone who wasn't startled. This kind of a question comes from imagining some fictitious world beyond the natural laws of our body minds. There's a famous story from the Middle Ages of some brigands swooping into a temple, and there was Ganto, great famous Zen master, sitting there, and he was run through with a sword and killed. And as he was run through, he let out, as the story goes, he let out a cry that was heard for miles, they say. When Hakuin, as a young monk, when he heard this story, he was thrown into doubt about the value of Zen practice. How could someone, even as of the stature of the great Ganto, how could he die like that? Well, who can explain that? But the fact is, or so we're told, that there was that response, a natural response. We read earlier from a talk from Bankei about illness. He says when you're in pain, just groan. What's diluted is when you're in pain thinking, well, I shouldn't be groaning because that's not what a real Zen person does, or not what an enlightened person does. It's just thoughts getting in the way of the direct experience, the natural response. When I was living with Roshi Kaplow in Mexico, I don't know, some 35 years ago or so, he suddenly came down with some terrible pain that turned out to be gallstones. And he was, in a matter of minutes, he was writhing in pain. So we had no choice but to try to find a doctor for him. We loaded him into our station wagon that we had with us there, the Zen Center station wagon, and had him lie down there, and off we went to Cuernavaca, the town about 10 miles away, or maybe 20 miles away. And he was part of the, on and off on that trip, he was groaning from the pain. Especially when we were driving out of the village where we lived. Tepoztlan has cobblestone streets, and I was driving along these cobblestone streets trying to get to a doctor as fast as I could, but driving as slow as I could because as we were bouncing over the cobblestones, he was crying out and groaning in pain. We can develop so many notions about Zen and what we're supposed to be like and the way we're supposed to talk and think and act. Zen is just being authentic, being who you are. If you have anxiety, there's just anxiety. If you're sad, you're sad. If you're in grief, you just cry, you're in grief. There's the other story of the master who his disciple found him crying on the along the road, and he said, "What happened? What's going on?" And he said, "My closest disciple just died." And the other one said, "Well, gee, I would have thought that by now you'd be beyond such such feelings." And the master said, "If I don't cry when my closest disciple dies, when would I cry?" So again, Bhante, if you feel startled, it's fine just to feel that way, as if it mattered whether it was fine or not. A startled response is beyond our control. It's fine just to feel that way. When you try to guard against it, you're creating duality. Once the master said, "When I first began to search for enlightenment, I wasn't able to find a good teacher, and as a result, did all sorts of painful practices, pouring out my heart's blood. Sometimes I'd forsake the company of others and go into seclusion. At other times, I'd fashion a paper mosquito net and, sitting inside it, practice meditation. Or else I'd shutter all the windows and meditate in my darkened room. Without permitting myself to lie down, I'd sit cross-legged until my thighs became inflamed with sores, the marks of which remained with me even afterward. At the same time, if I happened to hear a good teacher was to be found in some place or other, I'd set off at once to meet him. In this way, I spent several years, and I think I may say there were few places in Japan that I didn't leave my footprints. and all because I wasn't able to meet an accomplished teacher. Once I'd hit on enlightenment, I realized for the first time that I'd been struggling uselessly all those years and was able to achieve tranquility. I tell you all that without any struggle, you can attain complete realization now, right where you are, but you won't believe me because you're not truly serious about the Dharma. His point is not that there's no place for exertion, but that this mind of ours is never apart from us. It's right here, and if we could lay down our habit of dwelling in our thoughts, if we could just, it doesn't take Herculean exertion to just step out of that stream of thought. All it takes is that once, that one moment. And then our eyes are opened to the way things have always been. Now, the fact remains that Basui had to go through what he did. He must have, because he did. We can always look back at what our mistakes, if you want to call it that, we can look back at our mistakes and acknowledge that we needed to do that. We needed to go through what we went through. The Buddha needed to go through those 6 years of fearsome austerities in order to see through them. To discover the middle way that is neither self-punishment nor self-indulgent. He must have needed to do that. That was his karma. He needed to exhaust that karma by playing it out. And there are countless stories of great masters who went through the same painful struggles that Bunke went through. And that too is a kind of authenticity. If we recognize that we have no choice but to stay up night after night, we have no choice but to sit with the pain that we're sitting with, then we do it because we have no choice. Look back at the tremendous amount of the use of the stick in the 1970s in our sesshins, way, way, way more than we use now, and how I responded to that, how I look back with gratitude at how that helped me. Given who I was at the time, that's what I needed. And I'm only half kidding when I say that I might still be working on Mu had I not gotten all that rough treatment. So Bunke's point is, don't assume that we have to inflict this kind of pain on ourselves. But when we are driven the way he was, and we are driven the way the Buddha was, then we do what we feel we need to do. Do we really have any choice? Someone in a state of desperation who has tried everything else will then go to extremes. And it may very well bring results. there's a saying, something like, if a fool pursues his folly long enough, it will lead to wisdom. I think what Bonnke was trying to do is to release his monks from feeling that they had to model themselves after what he did. Maybe there were those in his assembly of monks who were subjecting themselves to the same torture because they thought they should, and he wanted to shake them out of their assumptions or their notions about such things. Once I asked the master, is it helpful in studying the way to read through the Buddhist sutras and the records of the old masters? The master said, it all depends. If you rely on the principles contained in the sutras and records, when you read them, you'll be blinding your own eyes. On the other hand, when the time comes that you can dismiss principles, if you read such things, you'll find the proof of your own realization. So, in so many words, he's warning us about being attached to principles. Principles are thoughts. We don't need to cling to thoughts called principles in order to find the way. It's so common in our culture to admire those who we feel have strong principles. But is it really the principles that we admire them for? Isn't it that we admire their upholding these timeless ways of conducting themselves? And that doesn't need to be, those aren't thoughts, it's not concepts. Principles can be huge attachments. It's somewhat a semantic thing. It depends on what we mean by them. But in Zen is a practice of finding our way with the body through physical training and practice, finding our way into what is the way, truth, which isn't a principle. It's a living reality. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.